he said. "What brings you out here today, Mr. Ramore?"
"Seeing the ancestral home of the Geller family isn't reason enough," Rufus asked. "I'm a little surprised to find you in residence."
"We call most of our bronze and silver rankers home when a monster surge is imminent," Danielle said. "The family has placed me in charge of defending the estate this time, and my husband and daughter will be back sometime in the next few months. Really, though, I'm back to overlook my son's final training."
"You really train all of your family members here?" Rufus asked.
"We do," Danielle said. "Our facilities might not be the Ramore Academy, but we're proud of it nonetheless."
"And rightly so, by all accounts," Rufus said. "I have heard my grandfather express his respect on more than one occasion."
"High praise indeed," Danielle said.
"If I may ask," Rufus said, "why here? I know this is where your family first rose up as a power, but now you're established in major cities around the world. Why send people born in high magic areas to train here?"
"We send everyone to train here," she said. "Those high magic areas are just the problem. Before you came here, did you ever go out on an expedition without at least a silver ranker to watch your back?"
"No," Rufus said darkly, "which led to a recent mistake on my part. Overconfidence led to insufficient caution. It almost cost my people everything."
"That is precisely the reason we still use this place," Danielle said. "The low magical density makes monsters weaker, the dangers smaller, the consequences less severe. Not to say there aren't real dangers, but we can send out our iron rankers to face them alone. No one to rely on but themselves and each other."
"You let them make their mistakes when those mistakes are less likely to kill them," Rufus said.
"Exactly."
"In light of my own hard-earned lesson," Rufus said, "I cannot see that as anything but an excellent practice. There may be a lesson for the way my own family does things."
"That's very flattering," Danielle said. "You really are a Ramore, aren't you? You're all obsessed with improving your academy's training methods."
"Speaking of training," Rufus said, "that is the reason I've come today. I've heard that your family's training facility includes a mirage chamber. I was hoping to borrow it from time to time during my stay here."
Danielle gave him an apologetic smile. "Indeed, we do have one," she said. "Sadly, as much as I would like to accommodate you, I cannot. As I mentioned, the local magical density is quite low. We can only operate our mirage chamber at a bronze rank level for limited periods, and I can't take that valuable training time away from my own family."
"Actually, it isn't for me," Rufus said. "I've found a person in rather desperate need of training, and have taken it upon myself to give him a rush course." She gave him a sideways glance, eyebrows arched.
"From what I hear," she said, "every aristocratic family in Greenstone has been asking you to guide their young hopefuls, including ours. I have to wonder how someone managed to catch your eye."
Rufus let out a self-deprecating laugh. "I mentioned my mistake," he said. "It would have gotten me killed, if not for a rather unusual man." Rufus shook his head. "I grew up surrounded by adventurers. I was raised not just to be one of them, but to be so good I could teach others. Everyone around me, as long as I can remember, told me I was going to be a great adventurer. It got to the point that I never even doubted it. The only exception was my grandfather. He said you never learn who you are when everything goes right. It's in your darkest hour that you understand what it is to be an adventurer."
They stopped walking at the edge of a pond, Rufus looking down at his own reflection.
"In my darkest hour," Rufus continued, "I met a man who had never even heard of the Adventure Society. One essence, no combat abilities. He didn't even know how to use spirit coins. But when all seemed lost, he showed me, like my grandfather said, what it means to be an adventurer. When all your training and powers fail you, you have to find something inside yourself you never knew was there. Then you can do things you never thought possible. It's the difference between a good adventurer and a great one."
That's a valuable lesson, Danielle said. It seems your time here wasn't wasted.
It hasn't been, Rufus said. Having received such a valuable lesson, I want to impart what I know in turn.
Well, Danielle said, if what you are looking for is some time in our Mirage Chamber running at iron rank, I can accommodate you. I would appreciate a little reciprocity, however.
Oh?
I mentioned my son and his final training. The time has come for him to join the Adventure Society, and I'd like you to do his field assessment. I'm sure the Society would be happy to accommodate.
I won't show your boy any favoritism, if that's what you're looking for, Rufus said. Danielle laughed.
Oh, I'd hardly need you for that, she said.
You're not suggesting the Adventure Society is subject to corruption? Rufus asked.
You have to realize, Mr. Ramore, this isn't Vitesse. The Adventure Society is a major force in Greenstone, but the isolation means the local branch is more reliant on local powers. Compromises must be made.
Dark clouds appeared in Rufus's expression. The neutrality of the Adventure Society is one of its central tenets, he said.
I agree, Danielle said. However, if the core branches want to export their values to remote branches like Greenstone, they need to export sufficient resources along with them. Ideals are well and good in the heart of a kingdom, Mr. Ramore, but here we are more often overlooked than not. In the provinces, we all have to deal with the realities.
Rufus looked rather dumbstruck. I'm not sure what to say to that.
There's nothing to be said. Welcome to the wilderness.
Surely it can't be that bad.
Oh, it's not, Danielle said. Especially with the new branch director. She worked her way up from the bottom, so she knows what it is to fight through the influence of families like mine. Remarkable woman, actually, but there is no getting around the fact that the Adventure Society here is reliant on local powers.
Is that why the adventurer standards are so low here? Rufus asked.
That's precisely the reason, Danielle said. Exceptions have a way of being made for those whose capabilities are not the equal of their connections. Eventually, standards just declined in general. That is why I want my son assessed to your standards. He doesn't need help. He needs to be challenged.
Then I would be happy to assist you, Rufus said. Challenge I can do. Jason was standing at the edge of the bridge, having just arrived on the island. The security guard handed back his permit after checking it.
Everything's in order, sir, the man said. First time on the island?
It is, Jason said. I don't suppose you could point out the quickest way to the Adventure Society? The guard gestured down the boulevard that followed straight out from the bridge.
Head up this way and you'll find the transit terminal. Big building, you can't miss it. That'll get you where you need to go.
Thanks, mate. Jason started walking up the street, past houses with gardens and grounds secured behind green brick walls and artfully wrought metal gates. Transit terminal, Jason muttered to himself as he walked along the street. Do they have magic trams or something? Soon Jason came to some kind of local shopping district, dominated by eateries and boutique stores. Jason wanted to stop and chase some of the enticing smells, but it was already afternoon. First, he needed to find the Adventure Society, then somewhere to stay before sundown so he could stay on the island. The shopping area was dominated by a large building with a sign declaring it the North Marina Transit Terminal. He went inside, finding it to be set out like a train station. He found a large sign that showed the routes, a pair of loop lines going in opposite directions. According to the map, Jason could reach the Adventure Society from Platform B. There didn't seem to be any place to buy tickets, so Jason took the stairwell marked for Platform B, descending to a below-ground level. The stairwell was long, around 2 stories worth of switchback stairs before coming out on a platform. It immediately reminded him of a subway platform in layout. The floor, walls, and ceiling were combinations of greenstone and tile mosaic, with cool, clean light coming from magical stones fixed into the ceiling. There were benches around the walls with people sitting patiently, while others stood. The difference from a subway station was that in front of the tunnel was a glass wall, with water behind it, like an aquarium. Three circular metal frames in the glass wall had doors that looked like airlocks. Moving closer to take a look, he saw the tunnel extended beyond both sides of the platform, like a subway tunnel. On the other side of the tunnel, he could see another glass wall with the same three doors, with another platform beyond that. The lights illuminating the platform started dimming in a gentle strobe. It was apparently some kind of signal. The other people at the platform started getting up from benches and moving towards the glass wall. Shortly thereafter, a bullet-shaped capsule floated down the tunnel and affixed itself to the wall with clamps that gripped the three metal circles and pressed tightly into the doors. With a hiss of air, the doors slid open and people came out. The people on the platform then boarded, Jason among them. The interior of the capsule was more like a bus than a subway car, with pairs of seats on each side. The seats were soft and plush, more like a luxury coach than cheap public transport. Jason found a window seat and watched the tunnel go past as the capsule took off. The ride had a floaty feel to it, and Jason couldn't stop himself from grinning like an idiot. "Submarine subways," he murmured to himself, shaking his head in disbelief. "I love magical cities." The tunnel outside his window was decorated in tile mosaic and lit with different colored lights. It seemed to be telling some kind of myth, with monsters and heroes locked in epic battle. He became so engrossed in the images going past that he was disappointed to arrive at his destination. The Adventure Society Terminal was two stops from where he started and was one of several buildings in the extensive Adventure Society campus. Jason followed a sign labeled Administration out of the building onto what looked like a prestigious old university, all stone buildings and sprawling grounds. Jason took what he guessed was the right path and only had to ask directions once before finding the administration building. He found himself in a large lobby appointed in wood, everywhere from the various sets of double doors to the three separate stairways. In terms of construction materials, Jason had seen plenty of mud brick, stone, tile, bamboo, even reeds. The sudden preponderance of wood was a sufficiently stark contrast to make clear the importance of the building. It was a vast space, which fortunately contained what looked like a reception desk, at which Jason presented himself. Behind the desk was what looked like the same paunchy, balding bridge guard who had given him directions. Only the clothes were different, the guard uniform replaced with a more civilian-looking outfit. It had a prominently stitched emblem of a sword and rod crossed over a shield. Jason had seen that emblem several times since arriving, recognizing it from Rufus's Adventure Society badge. The uniform had a loose fit Jason had seen on most of the locals, although the man's hefty midsection rather minimized the looseness. Jason noted there was a pencil tucked atop one of the man's ears.
"Do you have a brother?" Jason asked. "Just come over the bridge, sir."
"I did."
"That was my brother Bertram, sir. I'm Albert, but feel free to just call me Bert."
"No worries, Bert. Is this where I apply to join the Adventure Society?"
"Certainly is, sir," Albert said brightly. "I can get you started right away if you'd like."
"That'd be great." He pulled out a form and sat it on the desk, then started fishing through drawers.
"Not looking for a pencil, are you?" Jason asked. "I am, sir. Had it around here somewhere?"
Jason tapped his own ear, and a look of grateful revelation came over Albert's face as he plucked the pencil from its resting spot.
"Thank you, sir," Albert said. "How about we start with a name?"
"Jason Asano." Instead of writing it down, Albert gave Jason a curious look.
"Do you know an adventurer named Gareth Zandia?"
"Gareth Zandia?" Jason asked.
"Wait, do you mean Gary? Big, Leonid bloke?"
"Yes," Albert said. "The good-looking one."
"I knew it," Jason said, shaking his head in disgust.
"I'm sorry?" Albert asked. "Never mind," Jason said.
"Why do you ask about Gary?"
"He's been coming in and asking after you for the last couple of days," Albert said.
Is it all right to tell him you've registered?
Sure, Jason said, although I'd rather tell him myself.
Do you know where he's staying?
Chapter 38. Just Another Adventurer. The Guild District was the region of the island that contained the Adventure Society campus, along with many other guilds and societies. Occupying the northwest region of the island, the Guild District also contained the bulk of the island's visitor accommodations. Staying on the island was a relatively expensive prospect, but with price came quality. Rufus, Farah, and Gary had secured a 3-room suite in Sailor's Watch, an inn at the very edge of the island, with exceptional ocean views. Having returned from the Geller estate, Rufus ran into Farah outside their lodgings as she returned from her own business.
How did it go? Farah asked.
Well enough, Rufus said. Now we just need Jason to finally arrive.
Farah sniffed at the smell of fresh baking wafting out of the inn.
Smells good, she said. Should be just about time to get some supper.
It should, Rufus agreed, and they went inside. Walking in, they headed in the direction of the dining room. There was a doorway leading directly to the kitchen, from which they heard a familiar voice.
Now, it's equal parts sugar and water, then flavor to discretion. And I do mean discretion. You don't want the flavor of the syrup to overpower the cake. Once the syrup is soaking in, there's no getting it back out again. Unless you can extricate the syrup with magic somehow. I need to get my hands on a cooking magic skill book.
Farah snickered at the exasperation suddenly on Rufus's face.
Jason? Rufus called out.
Rufus!
Excuse me for a moment, ladies.
Jason wandered out of the kitchen, wearing an apron marked with flour.
G'day, he greeted them. Nice little place you found. A bit exy, but I picked up a decent bit of coin during our misadventures at the Vane Estate. Fighting cannibals is lucrative. I forgot to loot that woman, Cressida, though. Probably missed out on a good bit of coin there.
I still have your share from looting the manor, Farah said. They filched all the really good stuff before running off, but they left enough behind to be worth splitting up.
Oh, nice, Jason said. What took you so long? Rufus asked.
I took the scenic route through the Delta, Jason said. I had a good time.
There was some talk about someone roaming around healing people, Farah said. Did you hear about that?
How did you hear about it? Jason asked.
What we heard was that he was doing it for free, Farah said. The Church of the Healer wasn't happy. Did you see the guy?
Jason looked about shiftily.
Yep.
Seriously? Rufus asked. It was you?
I have that cleansing power, Jason said.
What happened to splitting up to prevent drawing attention? Rufus asked.
What did you want me to say?
Sorry, miss, but while it may seem that healing your father's horrifying illness would cost me nothing, someone might notice.
Surely there's a middle ground between doing nothing and walking the earth healing the sick and lame, Rufus said.
And where do I draw the line? Jason asked. Should it be where people aren't sick enough, or where they aren't impoverished enough?
He does have a point, Farah said. Who looks at the poor and sick and tells them they aren't poor and sick enough?
The Church of the Healer, from what I've heard, Jason said darkly.
I've seen this kind of thing before, Farah said. The healer likes to give his worshippers the freedom to make the right choices on their own. The Church of the Healer is really important in isolated areas like this, though, and more than one church leader has been known to go a bit power mad.
The God's real, right? Jason asked. Doesn't he step in? I've heard they do, if they take it too far, Rufus said. You always hear stories about churches who lose their way. I've never seen it reach the stage where their God intervenes.
I have, Farah said. Rufus is a big city boy, but it normally happens places like this, where there's less to keep them in check.
Did you at least go to the Adventure Society before getting to the kitchen? Rufus asked Jason.
Yeah, I did the paperwork, Jason said. I have some kind of assessment tomorrow.
That's just to clear you of things like restricted essences, Farrah said.
Once that's done, you'll need to go through a field assessment, Rufus said, which they do at the start of each month. The next one is in 9 days, but you can take yours the following month.
What's wrong with this month? Jason asked.
You won't be ready this month, Rufus said. Training you up to an acceptable standard by the end of next month will be rushed enough. 9 days from now, you wouldn't come close to passing.
You don't know for sure, Jason said.
I'm administering the field assessment myself, Rufus said, so I can speak with an amount of confidence.
You're doing it? Jason said.
Fair enough, then.
Having you assess me wouldn't exactly be ethical. Conflict of interest and all that. Well, I'll see you at dinner. I have to get back to my cake.
Rufus and Farrah watched Jason retreat into the kitchen.
He thinks he'd failed because of ethics? Farrah asked.
He'll figure it out once the training starts, Rufus said.
The Guild District was different from the North Marina District in which Jason had first arrived on the island. Rather than large private residences, it was occupied by various organizations, with smaller permanent residences serving the people that worked for them. Other than that, there was a large number of storefronts that seemed to be extensions of the various societies and associations headquartered around them. Two sprawling campuses dominated the Guild District. One was the Adventure Society, and the other was an organization called the Magic Society. Jason knew Farrah was a member, but only had a vague idea of what they did. From what he could gather, they were something between a magic university and a magic utility company. Judging by size and centrality, the Forge Society and the Alchemist Association were clearly second to the Adventure and Magic Societies, but still occupied impressive chunks of real estate. Other organizations in the district ranged from occupying large buildings to being clustered into one space with other groups. Some were trade organizations, while others were adventuring guilds, private organizations of adventurers banded together for varying purposes. Rufus had warned Jason against joining any of the local adventuring guilds. According to Rufus, they were all small-time affairs that took more from their members than they offered, although Jason wasn't entirely convinced. He'd learned enough about Rufus's background to realize Rufus looked down from a very great height. After arriving at the Adventure Society's administration building, Jason was shown through to a waiting room. There was one other occupant, a young man Jason estimated to be in his mid to late teens. He had the usual olive skin and dark hair of the local population, at least the human part of it. The young man was handsome, tall and broad-shouldered. If that wasn't bad enough, there was a puppy in his lap receiving a scratch on the tummy.
G'day, mate, Jason said, sitting down next to him. I like your dog.
His name is Stash, the young man said. Mine is Humphrey, Humphrey Geller.
Jason Asano, Jason said, shaking Humphrey's offered hand. Nice to meet you, Humphrey. Stash is an unusual name.
It's short for Velitraxastash, Humphrey said. He likes Stash, though.
Velitraxastash, Jason said. What is he, a shape-changed dragon or something?
Humphrey's eyes went wide.
How did you...
Wait, he actually is?
Jason burst out laughing, then reached over to scratch the puppy's tummy.
Who's a good little dragon? You are, yes you are, good boy.
The puppy transformed into a canary, flying out of Humphrey's lap to settle on his head, where it twittered away merrily.
That's impressive, Jason said. I take it he's still a baby dragon?
Yes, Humphrey said. Our mothers arranged him becoming my familiar, or me becoming his person, depending on how you look at it.
Your mum knows dragons, Jason said.
I guess mine does too, although it's more of a metaphor. Great Aunt Margaret doesn't literally breathe fire.
Humphrey laughed.
You're here to be assessed for the Adventure Society, I take it.
Yeah, I did all the paperwork yesterday, Jason said. Any idea of what to expect?
They'll just check to make sure you don't have any restricted abilities. There'll be an official from the Adventure Society, of course, but they're only there to oversee things. The actual checking will be done by a priest from the Church of Knowledge. Don't try to slip anything past them, because there isn't any point.
Because a god's involved?
Exactly. Then there'll be someone from the Magic Society to record your essences. They'll imply you have to let them record all your individual abilities. But you actually don't. I'm told that the trick is to let them know that you know you don't have to, and then do it anyway. Getting on the good side of the Magic Society is always a good idea.
Thanks for the advice.
If you've awakened any of your racial gifts, though, keep those to yourself, Humphrey advised. They're very big on those at the Magic Society, and you can trade the details in exchange for favours down the line.
Jason recalled Farrah telling him that humans all had dormant racial gifts that awakened unique powers based on their essences. He assumed the same advice would hold true for his outworlder abilities. More so, if anything.
Good to know, Jason said. Much appreciated, mate.
I hope you don't mind me saying, Humphrey said, but your manner of speech is a little unusual. Are you using a translation power?
I am, Jason said. I'm not local. I just arrived in town yesterday.
Where do you hail from, originally? Humphrey asked.
Australia.
Never heard of it, Humphrey said. Best not to tell Mother or she'll harangue my geography tutor. Does everyone there shave their eyebrows?
I didn't shave them, Jason said. I lost them.
How do you lose your eyebrows?
It's been an odd couple of weeks. A door opened and the canary on Humphrey's head morphed back into a puppy, its front paws dangling over his forehead. Humphrey lifted it down as a man entered the room. He was wearing what Jason had come to recognize as local business attire, quite different from the equivalent in his own world. The local fashions all went for loose, hanging designs that were more practical for the hot climate.
"Young Master Geller," the man said to Humphrey, not so much glancing at Jason. "This is, of course, a formality for you, but the formalities must be observed."
"I'm just another adventurer," Humphrey said, getting to his feet. "I only expect the same treatment you would give anyone."
"Of course," the man lied transparently. "This way, please."
Left alone in the waiting room, Jason absently tapped his feet.
"I need to do some clothes shopping," he said to himself. All his current outfits had been looted, and most of them hadn't travelled well.
"Rufus dresses nicely," he mused.
"Maybe he knows a place."
Humphrey wasn't gone long before coming back with Stash, still a puppy, tucked under one arm. Humphrey looked rather disconcerted, and was a full shade redder than when he left.
"You all right?"
"The priest," Humphrey said, breathlessly. "She was a priestess."
"Pretty?" Jason guessed.
"Oh, gods, yes," Humphrey said. "I'm sure I made an idiot of myself."
"You don't have to worry," Jason said, scratching Stash behind the ear. "You've got this little guy."
She did seem to like him.
"Of course she did."
I didn't know what to say.
"I'm sure it was fine. I didn't even get her name."
"No worries," Jason said, slapping Humphrey on the shoulder. "I'll get her name. You hang about in the lobby for a few minutes and we'll grab an early lunch. Sound good?"
"You'd do that for me?"
"Mate, I'm going in there anyway. It's not exactly out of my way."
Jason sent the still flustered Humphrey back in the direction of the main lobby. Shortly after, the man who had come for Humphrey then came out to get Jason.
"Mr. Asano?" he asked, all smiles.
"That's right."
"Do you know young Master Geller well?"
"We just met here."
Friendliness sank from the man's face, like a torpedo had struck it.
"Oh," the man said flatly. "Well, come on then, we haven't got all day."
The man marched off, not bothering to look if Jason was following.
"Wow."
Jason trailed the man through a small antechamber, and then into another room, where two people were waiting. The woman wore flowing robes of blue and white, with a sigil of a book sewn prominently into them.
He saw what had gotten Humphrey so bothered, and she was quite pretty, although still with the rounded edges of youth. She was Humphrey's age, maybe 16 or 17,
and Jason guessed Humphrey would have to move quick, or in a couple of years he'd have a small army of rivals. Jason hadn't seen any evidence of cosmetics in this world, but he was beginning to suspect essences were taking up the slack. Except for himself and the blood priest Daryl, every essence user he'd seen ranged from moderately good-looking to stupidly attractive. The man next to the priestess was in his mid-30s, also in a robe. Where the priestess's garment draped down her body with grace and elegance, his looked like a sack held in place with a rope belt. He had stubble, not the sexy kind, and his hair was an unruly mess. Even then, Jason recognized the handsome bone structure underneath. He looked like the hapless man who gets a makeover from the love interest in Act 2. The third person was the man who led Jason in. He looked to be around 30, with the generic handsomeness of a guy who had a supporting role on a teen drama a few years ago, but didn't break out and is really bitter about going back to his catering job. "So you'll be the Adventure Society guy," Jason said to him. He had the aura of a bronze ranker, although not as strong as Rufus, Gary, and Farrah. They were all near the top end of bronze, where this one felt more like Anissa, who had only recently moved past iron rank. "And you must be the priestess," he greeted the young woman. "Jason Asano. Lovely to meet you. May I have your name, or do I just call you Your Worship, or something? The last priestess I met was a bit of a stickler. She did like to keep things formal, but mostly she just didn't like me." She shook Jason's hand with a laugh. Jason mused over a handshake being common across worlds when it wasn't even universal to his own.
"My name is Gabrielle Pellin," she said, "and I'm just an acolyte, not a full priestess. You can call me Gabrielle."
"Is it all right just to have an acolyte?" Jason asked. "What if I'm really good at hiding how evil I am?"
"It is unusual," Gabrielle said, "but my lady directed me specifically to be here today."
"Your lady?"
"The goddess Knowledge."
"Is that her actual name? Knowledge? I suppose it would be weird if she was called Beryl or something. Especially if your name was Beryl. It'd make church service confusing, although I imagine quite flattering as well." He turned to the last person as the other three looked at him strangely. "You must be from the Magic Society," Jason said. "Not sure what they do yet, but they seem very important, so well done there. Jason Asano, nice to meet you, mate."
I'm Russell," the man said, warily shaking Jason's hand. "You don't know what the Magic Society does?"
"I'm not a local," Jason said. He noted that the priestess, Gabrielle, was holding what looked like a crystal ball, while Russell had a clipboard. "So how do we do this, then?" Jason asked. "She waves the thing at me and you write down what she sees?"
"That's more or less the process," Russell said.
"Great," Jason said. "Fair warning, my essences might come across as a bit sinister, but they weren't on the restricted list. Not when I checked, anyway."
"You don't know what the Magic Society does," Russell said, "but you know enough to check the restricted list."
"It's been an odd couple of weeks," Jason said. "I'm picking things up as I go." "Can we please get started?" the man from the Adventure Society asked impatiently.
"Yes, sorry," Gabrielle said.
She held up the crystal orb in front of Jason. She frowned at it, giving it a small shake.
"Miss Pellin?" Russell prompted.
"It seems Mr. Asano is impervious to the aura reader," Gabrielle said.
"Just call me Jason. Don't worry, I'm not evil. I'll cop to naughty, but that's as far as it goes. Of course, that's what an evil guy would say, isn't it?"
"I'm not sure what anyone would say," Gabrielle told him. "I think you might be a rather unusual man."
"No," Jason said. "Commoners mock me."
"That I believe," the Adventure Society official said.
Gabrielle tilted her head, as if distractedly listening to something.
"After we're done here," Russell said to Jason, "could I convince you to discuss the power that shields you from the aura reader?"
"Got lunch planned, sorry."
"Sorry," Gabrielle said, refocusing on the group. "The essences were dark, blood, sin, and doom.
The other two turned to look at Jason.
What?
He asked. I said I'm not evil, although that could be part of my cunning ruse. Still, not on the restricted list, yeah? It's not like I can make zombies or something. Kind of played out where I come from, zombies. Same with vampires. Not as many werewolves, but they haven't been done well in a while. Probably need the moon essence if I was going to make werewolves, though. My friend Rufus has the moon essence, but he's more of the swordsman type.
Would you please stop talking for about 5 seconds? The Adventure Society official said.
Sorry about that. Whatever your name is, I didn't catch it. Is this your only job, or do you do catering on the side?
What?
Shut up. Russell, record this idiot's essences so we can get him out of here.
Just a moment, Russell said.
He was looking over a blue and white marble tablet of a kind Jason had seen before. Farah had checked an identical one when they were looking up Jason's essences.
Here we are, Russell said. Dark, blood, sin, and doom. Affliction specialist, no restriction. You're all good to go, Mr. Asano.
Thanks, mate.
Very well, the official said, writing on his own clipboard.
You're cleared for field testing. Should you successfully complete field testing, you will be allowed to take up membership with the Adventure Society with all privileges and responsibilities that entails. Field testing takes place at the start of every month, and you can sign up at the administration desk.
There is the matter of registering your individual essence abilities, Russell said.
I'm going to give that one a miss. Sorry, mate, Jason said. I would, but I have a friend waiting outside. Lovely to meet you, Russell. Gabrielle? He turned to the official.
Guy?
How did you know my name was Guy? The official asked.
Seriously? I'm on a roll today. Bye, all.
Jason sauntered out of the room.
What an unusual man, Russell said.
I thought he was fun, Gabrielle said.
I thought he was on drugs, Guy said.
The other two looked at him, then nodded.
That would make sense, Russell said.
Will that be a problem for his membership? Gabrielle asked.
No, Guy said. If we banned that kind of thing, we'd have to kick out half the alchemists.
Chapter 39 Training.
As you hopefully recall, Rufus said, there are three elements to improving your abilities.
I'm pretty sure the middle step was to eat a delicious sandwich, Jason said.
Could you take this at least a little seriously? Rufus asked.
I'm about to learn magic kung fu, so probably not.
Jason had rented a suite room on the same floor as the others, right across the hall. It was smaller. Or more accurately, less large. Being on the other side of the building, it didn't have the same ocean view, and he spent much of his time in their suite. They were having iced tea out on the balcony, overlooking the ocean.
There's nothing wrong with having some fun along the way, Gary said. As long as the work gets done, why be so serious about everything?
He says that sipping iced tea on the balcony, Farah said. He turns into a slave driver once the training starts.
Even I think it's a bit much, Rufus said.
No, you don't, Gary said.
No, Rufus said with a malicious grin. I don't.
What's kung fu? Farah asked. I don't think your ability translated it.
It means a skill developed through discipline and hard work, Jason said. Anything can be kung fu if you're diligent about it.
Actually, Rufus said, that's a good attitude.
See? Gary said. You're not at very serious academy now, Rufus. Hard work is easier to get through if you find a way to enjoy it.
Gary may have fun, Farah said, but you probably won't. Don't get carried away, Gary.
When do I ever get carried away? Gary asked.
Remember Angelina? Rufus asked.
Are you ever going to let that go? Gary said. How was I meant to know she was evil?
The first time we met her, she tried to sell us poison, Farah said. We were in a church, and not one of the bad ones.
I think we should keep our attention on the task at hand, Rufus said. Tomorrow we'll do everything together, just for the first day. After that we'll split up. You won't be able to keep up with us when we're pushing ourselves. Gary will be in charge of your basic physical training, I'll be working on your combat skills, and Farah will help you with mental training and meditation.
We had to go out so you could get more clothes today, Gary said. But normally we'll begin bright and early. For the first week, I'm just going to run you until you can't run anymore.
I figured it would be something like that, Jason said. I was thinking we could run over the bridge and into the old city. Gary looked over at Rufus, who shrugged.
Works for me, Gary said. Doesn't really matter where you run to, as long as you run.
All four of them ran from their lodgings to the bridge in the early light. They weren't the only ones out, with others also running on the island's wide, well-paved streets.
Adventurers? Jason asked.
Those are the good ones, Rufus said. As with most things, the best results come through diligent effort.
On the other hand, Farah said, if you use magic cores to advance, you get to sleep in.
Don't tempt him into bad habits, Rufus scolded.
There was very little early hours traffic on the island, although some tradesfolk were making their way with carts and wagons. These, like the expensive carriages Jason had seen, were propelled by magic rather than pulled by animals.
Not allowed to have drawn vehicles on the island, Rufus explained. Makes it more expensive for working people, but they make up for it in prices. On the island, you'll pay twice, maybe three times the price you would for the same thing in the old city.
At the bridge, they had to show their access permits. Jason had taken lodging at the same inn as the other three, which earned him a temporary residence permit for the island. The guard checking their permits turned out to be a familiar face.
Bertram, right? Jason said.
You can call me Bert, Bertram said. You meet my brother at the Adventure Society?
He helped me with my adventurer registration.
Once they had crossed the bridge, the streets of Old City were considerably busier. The four stood out, weaving through teamsters and merchants as they maintained a running pace. By the time they reached their destination, Jason was exhausted. He leaned against a wall, dragging in heavy breaths. The others looked up at the sign over the door.
Broad Street Clinic, Rufus read out loud. Shouldn't Broad Street be two words?
One word, Jason said. It's the actual name of the street.
It's called Broad Street Street?
Gary asked.
Broad Street Boulevard, Jason said. How am I telling you this? You've all spent much more time in this city than me.
We don't spend a lot of time in the old city, Farah said. The island is just nicer.
You know someone here?
Rufus asked, nodding at the clinic doors.
Met him on my way into the city, Jason said.
Having recovered his breath a little, he stumbled in through the doors, the others following after. Inside was a waiting room, crowded with people and a reception desk with a young woman sitting behind it. Jason leaned onto the desk, using it to keep himself upright.
Sir, if you require emergency treatment...
I'm Jason Asano, he panted out.
Ah, right, the woman said. Are you all right?
I will be.
The alchemist Jason had entered the city with, Jory, emerged from the back room. He was leading an elderly lady who carried a small bag.
Now, only take the medicine right before bed, Jory said.
So I should take it with dinner?
The lady asked.
No, you'll pass out at the table, right before bed. Seriously, right before you climb into bed.
So when I sit down for my evening wine?
No, right before bed.
Would it be easier if I took it during the day?
She asked.
I'm just going to take that for a moment,
Jory said, retrieving the small bag from the lady. Jory spotted the bedraggled Jason, giving him an odd look as he passed, leading the woman to a middle-aged man quietly waiting in one of the seats. Jason couldn't hear them talk, although he did hear the man say something about dinner as Jory's arm, held rigidly at his side, clenched into a fist. Soon after, the pair were on their way, and Jory came over to Jason.
You showed up, then?
Jory said.
Yeah,
Jason said. These are my friends, by the way. Gary, Farah, Rufus, meet Jory.
This is a medical clinic?
Gary asked.
Just alchemy?
So far, Jory said. I met Jason the other day and he offered to help out. Jory led Jason into a back room, then started bringing patients in, one after the other. For each one, Jason chanted out his spell.
Feed me your sins.
Ability, feast of absolution, sin, spell, recovery, cleanse, cost, low mana, cooldown, 20 seconds, current rank, iron, 1, 19%. Effect, iron. Cleanse all curses, diseases, poisons, holy afflictions, and unholy afflictions from a single ally or enemy. Recover stamina and mana for each affliction cleansed. This ability circumvents any resistance or immunity to cleanse effects. This ability cannot be used on self. Jason used his Feast of Absolution power to remove their diseases, along with a few other toxins like alcohol, which registered to his ability as a poison.
That's a good cleansing ability, Gary observed between patients. Good way to practice it, too. It really gives you stamina back.
Mana, too, Jason said. Can't use it on myself, though.
I knew there had to be a pretty rough restriction with a power that good,
Gary said. I'm surprised people aren't a bit more wary with an incantation like that, Rufus said.
These people don't care what you chant, Jory said. If there's free healing going, they'll cheer you on as you praise the god of woe.
With each patient, Jason's mana and stamina were replenished until he was back at full strength.
You all right? Gary asked. You look a lot better, but a bit down.
It's just, Jason sighed. My world doesn't have magic. We don't have a way to get rid of some of the diseases I've just casually taken away from people today. I cured a dozen people of cancer. Do you know what cancer does to a person?
No,
Gary said.
Exactly. I think about what I could do if I took this power home with me.
You'll get there, Gary said. Maybe it'll take a while, but you'll get there.
You think? Jason asked.
When you have some time, go over to the Temple District, Gary said. Maybe the goddess Knowledge will help you. She probably won't straight up tell you how to get home, but she might put you on the right path.
Really?
Probably, Gary said. She makes you work for it, but guiding people to knowledge is kind of her whole purpose for being.
Not today, though, Rufus said. Today is for training. You're ready to get back to running, right?
If we're done here, Jason said.
You are, Jory said. We've run out of sick people. There'll be more tomorrow once word starts getting around you're doing this for free.
Not a problem, Gary said. I'll be dragging him along every morning.
Rufus and an exhausted Jason stood on a training field on the Adventure Society campus. At least Rufus was standing, with Jason sprawled out on the grass. Farrow was nearby, leaning against a tree as she read a book. There were other people around sparring or practicing martial arts forms. Gary had wandered off and was sparring against a pair of locals.
I don't suppose there's a bunch of sick people around?
Jason asked, too weary to stand.
Afraid not, Rufus said. Should I eat a spirit coin?
Jason asked.
No, Rufus said. Replenishing yourself is good when you need to keep pushing, but you also need to let your body restore itself naturally. Your recovery attribute needs training just as much as your speed, power, and spirit.
I don't feel like I'm ready to learn martial arts right now, Jason said.
You're not, Rufus said. Actual technique you can pick up from a skill book.
I can? Jason asked, raising his head. Great. Let's do that.
Not yet, at my family's academy.
Drink,
Jason said.
What?
I've come up with a drinking game, Jason said. Every time you say, my family's academy, everyone has to take a drink.
Farrah burst out laughing.
Is this the fun you were talking about? Rufus asked, disapproval wrinkling his brow. Sorry, Jason said, as he got to his feet. He dropped to a half crouch, hands on his knees. I think I'm going to throw up. Good, Rufus said. It means you've been pushing yourself hard enough. At my family's academy, Rufus glared at Farah, who was looking innocently off into the distance. We have been refining methods of combat training for centuries, including training with skill books. Isn't the whole point of skill books to just use them and you're good? It isn't that simple, Rufus said. For a practice that is knowledge-based, that is more or less true. No, it isn't, Farah chimed in. Knowing isn't the same as understanding. You've used a ritual magic skill book, but knowing practical applications isn't the same as grasping the theory. There's a similar issue with physical skills, Rufus said, but even more exaggerated. The mind might know what to do, but the body still has to learn. First, I will teach you to be receptive to the skills you will learn, how to stand, how to move. A solid house needs a solid foundation, Jason said. Exactly, Rufus said, happily. I'm glad you understand. Learning to fight through skill books is ultimately faster than training from nothing, because you save yourself years of repetition to ingrain the skills. There is a danger, however, of not fully comprehending the techniques. By preparing well before using a skill book, then consolidating well after, you avoid developing flaws in your skill set. Plus, I imagine there's quite a gap between learning technique and learning to fight, Jason said. It's good you realize that, Rufus said. It's the first thing we have to beat out of skill book users at my family's academy. Rufus pressed his lips thinly together as he heard a snort of choked-off laughter. Flashing a glance at Farah, he let out a weary sigh. Stand up straight, he said to Jason. We begin with footwork. Jason had joined Farah in reclining against a tree. Gary was still sparring against all comers, currently going 1-3. Rufus had sat down to meditate. You did well with Rufus's training, Farah told Jason. I was amazed you didn't complain when he just had you taking funny steps the whole time. I'm not sure how my translation ability will handle the term kung fu movies, but we have these stories in my world about learning to fight. You always start with what seems weird and pointless, but ends up being the most important of fundamentals. There's usually a life lesson in there somewhere as well. Rufus is going to hate teaching you. You are nothing like the students at his academy. Is his school actually that big deal? It really is, Farah said. Kings and queens have studied there, some of the best adventurers in the world, too. Did you and Gary train there? Farah laughed. Definitely not. Our origins are a bit too humble for that. We all met on the job. Right, Jason said. The zombies. We worked together well, and I think Rufus's grandfather quietly pushed things along. Rufus puts more pressure on himself than anyone else does, and I think his grandfather was hoping we would lighten him up. How's that going? Jason asked. You should have seen Rufus when we first met, she said. He was like a string, constantly pulled taut. It was only so long until he was going to snap. She looked around with a smile. Coming out here has been good for him, getting away from everything. He blames himself for you getting captured, though. Mistakes are inevitable, Farah said. But it was good they happened so far from home. He doesn't have to feel like people are looking over his shoulder as he makes them. Farah was wearing the loose, draped clothes in the local style, including a long coat robe that made her look a bit like a Jedi. She reached into it and pulled out an awakening stone that she tossed casually to Jason. It was like dark glass, shining with a faint radiance of moonlight. It was cool in his hand. Item: Awakening Stone of Omens. Unranked. Epic. An awakening stone containing the power of destiny. Consumable. Awakening stone. Requirements: Unawakened Essence Ability. Effect: Awakens an Essence Ability. You have 9 Unawakened Essence Abilities. You are able to absorb Awakening Stone of Omens. Absorb: Yes, no. What's this for? Jason asked.
We haven't forgotten that you saved us back in that ritual chamber, Farah said. We've each gotten you a gift, something to help you start your adventuring life.
You saved me too. Even if I'd gotten away, I probably would have died in that desert.
Maybe. But saving us took courage and heroics. Saving you just took a basic sense of direction. Use the stone. It wasn't easy to find.
High-rarity stones tend to be more specialized, right?
That's right.
This one is epic. What are you expecting me to get?
With luck, an aura ability. Although, maybe not. That was the rarest stone I could get my hands on that is known for aura powers. Every good adventurer should have a perception power or an aura ability, and the perception power you already have. Once you have an aura ability, you can learn to control your aura.
And that's important?
Very. Anyone who hits bronze rank and can't manage their aura is a second-rate adventurer, and you can't do that without an aura ability.
Well, we can't have that, Jason said. The stone sank into his hand.
You have awakened the Sin Essence ability, Hegemony. You have awakened 4 of 5 Sin Essence abilities.
Chapter 40 I-Beams and the Ethics of Adventuring. After finding out Jory had an unused courtyard behind his clinic, Rufus moved the daily training there. It was really just a walled-in dirt yard, but was sufficient for their needs. The day would begin with Gary, who would run with Jason to Jory's clinic. After replenishing his stamina by draining the sickness from Jory's patients, Jason was ready for more physical training. The approach to physical training was startling in its familiarity. Farah had left a set of barbells from her magical chest in Jory's yard, covered with a tarp. Gary would alternate between strength training with weights and more agility-based training, leading Jason through all kinds of flexibility exercises. While instructing Jason, the normally relaxed Gary became a harsh taskmaster, brooking not even the slightest amount of slack. As he watched Jason's form during push-ups, sit-ups, or lunges, he would lecture on the importance of training.
"When your speed attribute reaches bronze," Gary said, "you will be faster than you ever were before. If you don't know how to use that speed, that agility, those reflexes, then you will die to someone that does."
Sometimes Gary would take Jason out of the clinic's yard and into streets and alleys of Old City. He taught what Jason was startled to recognize as parkour. Climbing, roof-running, acrobatics. In spite of his huge body, Gary was astoundingly proficient. Jason voiced concern about this strategy, given the generally busy state of Old City and his own lack of expertise. Gary insisted on a learn-by-doing approach, telling Jason what he did wrong as he did it. Jason voiced the same concerns again after he fell from a rooftop and had to pay for the crushed contents of a fruit cart.
"Sorry about that, Herbert," Jason said as he handed over the coins.
"I look at it this way," the balding, paunchy fruit seller said. "I just sold a full cartload of fruit and it's barely daylight. And please, call me Bert."
"I'm not sure this is working out," Jason told Gary.
"You don't just start off good at difficult things," Gary said. "You have to begin at bad and work your way up."
"That I get," Jason said. "I'm just not sure about the methodology. Maybe I should try somewhere less crowded until I'm better?"
"The ability to move with speed and confidence, always aware of your surroundings, is essential to an adventurer," Gary said. "Sometimes you have to run, sometimes you have to chase. You rarely get to choose when or where. You must always be ready, always aware. Whatever you're doing, wherever you're doing it."
Once Gary was done with him, Jason would replenish himself again with clinic patients. On the first day, Jason noticed Jory giving him a wary look.
"What?"
Jason asked.
"I know you're helping people and all," Jory said, "but you're literally feeding on the misery of others."
"You want me to stop coming in?"
"Gods, no."
"All right, then," Jason said.
I don't suppose you want to help me stitch a body together from dismembered corpses and animate it with lightning?
That would be disturbing, Jory said, if he didn't so obviously know nothing about actual necromancy.
Word of Jason's free healing started getting around, so there were always people waiting each time he arrived. By the time he cleared out the patients, Rufus would arrive for more training. The training with Rufus was the most tedious part of Jason's day. Footwork and balance, footwork and balance. Sometimes it was moving around with a forced gait, feeling awkward and inefficient. Other times it was balancing in strange stances on pegs Jory let Rufus hammer into the dirt yard. Whenever Jason's form was wrong, Rufus would sweep his legs out from under him, or kick him from what he was balancing on.
You're breaking your body line. Anyone with even rudimentary skills would put you on the ground in a moment.
It feels awkward to move like that, Jason said.
That is because you don't walk, run, stand, lean, or sit properly. When it stops feeling awkward, you'll be ready to use a skill book.
So I could just lie and we move on to the skill book?
Rufus's leg swept Jason's out from under him with such force that Jason went horizontal in the air, followed by a savage downward chop, smashing him into the ground.
Rufus stood over him as Jason curled up in the dirt, choking and coughing.
There will be a test, Rufus said.
In the afternoons, Farrah would take over. This was the part of his training regimen Jason enjoyed the most. Gary and Rufus's instruction was classic montage material, while Farrah's training was something altogether different. The spirit attribute, Jason learned, governed not just magic strength, but also perception. Farrah subjected Jason to an array of unusual, but often interesting and fun exercises. They would play memory games with cards, or she would make him taste test things while blindfolded.
I have no idea what you just put in my mouth, Jason said, but you need to tell me what it was. I want to try baking it in a pie.
Some perception exercises train practical observation and memory skills. One of the most common was watching people go past Jory's clinic, with Jason memorizing everything he could as fast as he could. He would then close his eyes as Farrah tested him. Other times, she would have him read from the Magic Society's monster records, collected on a magical tablet. She gave him only a short time to read, testing his comprehension afterwards. The second aspect of Farrah's training was meditation. Jason and his siblings had been spoon-fed meditation techniques by their mother, and while Jason had long ago rejected them, it at least gave him a grounding to work with. Those techniques were quite different to what Farrah taught him, but there was enough commonality to pick things up quickly. She soon stopped guiding him, leaving him to take it up in his own time. The final part of Farrah's training was aura manipulation. He had gotten lucky, the stone Farrah gifted him, awakening an aura ability. Ability, hegemony, sin, aura, holy, unholy, cost, none, cooldown, none, current rank, iron, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Allies within the aura have increased resistance to afflictions, while enemies within the aura have their resistance to afflictions reduced. Enemy resistances are further reduced for each instance of sin they are suffering from. Jason was happy with the aura effect, which would make his abilities more reliable while protecting his allies from someone like him. He was also fascinated by it being both a holy and unholy ability at the same time. Sadly, he couldn't think of a good way to passive-aggressively let Anissa hear about it. He knew she was in the city somewhere, but it was probably for the best they hadn't run into each other. As Farrah instructed Jason on the basics of aura use, he discovered that for training purposes, the specifics of his aura didn't matter. The fundamental aspects of auras were all the same, which she introduced him to in the clinic yard as they sat on woven mats.
By getting your hands on an aura power, Farrah told him, you've gained the capacity to manipulate your aura. Like any other skill, it takes practice to do it right. Controlling your aura is important for many reasons, starting with the fact that as you get stronger, your aura will become increasingly energetic. Eventually, it will be enough to be dangerous to the people around you. If you reach gold rank and can't control your aura properly, you can hurt normal people just by going near them.
So if you hit gold rank and can't control your aura, Jason asked, do you have to hide so you don't hurt people just by walking down the street?
There are magic items you can use to suppress your aura. People in that situation are required to use them.
Do you get a lot of people who get to gold without any aura control?
No, Farrah said. Usually your chances of getting to gold start with a good foundation, which means aura powers and aura training. It does happen, though. I once saw the aftermath of a gold ranker who forgot to put on an aura suppressor before going to a market. People were passed out, bleeding out their ears.
That's not good.
No, it isn't, Farrah said, which is why the training is important. There are other reasons, too. Anyone with a perception power will eventually be able to see auras clearly, so if yours isn't under control, they'll read you like you're holding up signs. Not just your location, either. If you can't restrain your aura, they'll read your emotions, know when you lie.
Can you see my emotions right now? Jason asked.
No, Farrah said, but my perception power doesn't improve my aura sense until silver rank. Neither does yours, by the way. I looked it up.
So what does your perception power do?
It looks good,
Farrah said, as her eyes turned into glowing embers. It also lets me see through smoke and mist.
Nice, Jason said.
Wait, what about my clothes-changing ability? That hides me in smoke. Can you see through that?
That's an interesting question, Farrah said. You know, if I ever get to diamond rank, I can shoot fire out of my eyes.
That doesn't answer my...
Wait, you're going to get eye beams? That's awesome.
I know, right? Farrah said. There aren't a lot of abilities where we know what happens at diamond rank. Rufus thinks that if I actually get there, it will be overshadowed by what my other abilities can do.
Then Rufus sucks, Jason said. He thinks eye beams won't be useful? The intimidation factor alone would be amazing. Who's going to meet your eyes when you can shoot heat beams out of them?
That's what I said, Farrah agreed. More or less. I didn't say heat beams.
Eye beams are sweet.
I think we may be getting off topic.
All right, Jason said. So what do I do?
Broadly speaking, you can control your aura in three ways, and I'll teach you them in order.
Sounds good, Jason said.
The first two uses are the easiest, Farrah said. They are, broadly speaking, projecting your aura and restraining it, which is exactly what it sounds like. Projecting is pushing your aura out to affect people, and restraining it is used drawing it in, whether to hide it or just not be rude.
Or make people's ears bleed, Jason said.
Exactly, Farrah said.
What about the third one?
That's using your aura to suppress the auras of other people. It's harder than the others, and you should leave it alone until you reach a certain level of proficiency with aura manipulation.
Fair enough.
We start with projecting, because you're doing it already.
I am?
You are. Everyone is until they learn not to. It's what makes people with no aura control easy to read. I'll also be teaching you how to hide your emotions even as you're projecting your aura to affect people.
Can monsters manipulate their aura?
Higher rank monsters can, Farrah said. At your level, even mine, really, the most you'll find is a few stealthy monsters that restrain their auras to hide better.
I think stealth is going to be my thing, too, Jason said. I'd best learn to restrain my aura properly.
You're meant to be learning everything properly, she said. I'll teach you all the fundamentals, expanding your aura, narrowing it down onto some people and not others. Once I've taught you, though, it's your responsibility to keep practicing. Diligence makes the difference between crudely tossing around your aura and deft manipulation.
Then I won't make my neighbors bleed out their eyeballs.
You're a long way from needing to worry about that, Farrah said. A long way. But eventually, yes. More immediately, the skill with which we control our auras is how adventurers make their first impressions on one another. If you can't do it properly, people won't take you seriously. Excellent aura manipulation marks you as an adventurer of training and distinction.
So you're saying if I don't control my aura properly, I won't get invited to the nice parties? Jason said.
Something like that, Farrah said.
When the rich and powerful bring contracts to the Adventure Society, they add bonus rewards to entice the best adventurers. At your rank, these contracts are usually first come, first serve. Once you go higher, clients start requesting specific adventurers. That's when your reputation matters. If your aura control is sloppy, you won't get a second glance.
Good to know.
You're not expected to have the skill at Iron Rank, of course, Farrah said. That's the time you're meant to be mastering the basics, after all. But if you don't have a handle on it by the time you reach Bronze, you'll find a lot of doors closing in your face.
Rufus told me that just being an adventurer opens every door.
Yes, well, Rufus may not be the best authority on what life is like for the average adventurer.
The ones not born with talent, looks, wealth, privilege, and influence?
Exactly. He grew up in one of the most prestigious adventure preparatory schools in the world, with kings and the children of heroes as friends. He's a great guy, but he's oblivious to what the rest of us go through sometimes.
So, to him, adventuring is just a parade of people telling you how great you are and handing you sacks of cash.
Exactly. I'm not saying the rest of us can't get there, but Rufus never even saw the low rungs of the ladder. The things we're teaching you now, he was learning from the womb.
Then, if I'm going to catch up, we should probably get back to the lesson, Jason said.
I like the ambition, Farrah said. First, let me take you through the process. As I said, we start with projection to learn the basics, then move on to restraining. Once you can do both of these to an acceptable level, we introduce more sophistication. Things like focusing on one person or hiding aspects of your aura while projecting. That culminates in projecting and restraining at the same time.
How does that work?
Well, for example, just say you've hidden yourself, but you want to use your aura. So you blanket the area with your aura ability, but hide your presence within it.
Sounds like a good intimidation tactic, Jason said. They know you're around, stalking them, but can't find you.
Or you could just blow one of them up, Farrah said. I find that intimidates the survivors just fine.
You're a very aggressive person.
There's nothing wrong with enjoying your work.
There is when your work is killing people.
I was talking about monsters, Farrah said, her tone lowering with disapproval. They're just globs of magic.
But they can still feel fear and pain. They still suffer.
So do the people.